happy. The gold of Allenby.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
According to an internal memo, government workers at the nation's airports are constantly subjected to abuse and extreme stress. The memo, written by Marcia Florian, the federal security director in Phoenix, Arizona, and obtained by the Seattle Times, says screeners have endured false promises from hiring contractors, weeks or months with no pay or benefits, mandatory conversion to part-time, forced overtime, and now a recertification process that shows no regard for screener morale, effectiveness, or livelihood. The Times interviewed more than 100 current or former Transportation Security Administration employees who verified multiple abuses. The Department of Homeland Security placed Florian on administrative leave Tuesday morning.
The International Professional and Technical Engineers have members concentrated in the swing states of Pennsylvania and Washington. IFPTE Legislative Political Director Matt Biggs has seen firsthand how the Bush administration's policies hurt labor.
With respect to the Department of Homeland Security, when he created that, he aimed to gut union rights, and he did that, as well as civil service protections that federal employees historically enjoy. And his latest maneuver is through the Department of Defense, which employs 720,000 federal civil servants nationwide. The President and Secretary Rumsfeld are aiming to completely gut the collective bargaining, the pay structures, the veterans' preference, and EEOC protections, among other things, of the 720,000 federal civil servants employed by DOD. So it was pretty much a no-brainer. Senator Kerry's record on all of these issues, by the way, is stellar.
The clock is ticking as the World Trade Organization tries to hammer out the framework for trade talks by the end of the week. Last year's WTO conference in Cancun, Mexico, imploded amid deep rifts between rich and poor countries. The discussions, currently being held in Geneva, are an attempt to mend those rifts. However, the organization is already walking a thin line, as African nations have expressed they will not sign anything unless their concerns about subsidies paid to cotton farmers in rich countries, namely the United States, are addressed. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Depending on whose statistics you choose, the unemployment rate in Iraq runs between 28 and 50%. For a proper perspective on this catastrophe, the unemployment rate in the United States during the Great Depression peaked at 25%, and the situation is getting worse. Iraqi construction firms have been cut out of all but the smallest rebuilding projects, and American contractors are importing cheap labor from Pakistan and India instead of giving the work to Iraqis who desperately need it.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send you a job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in a recovery. And after a year, you finally land another job, and you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
Good news, Americans. The Crawford Five are free. As I reported to you earlier this year, five Texans were victims of one of the most bizarre incidents in George W.'s ongoing autocratic assault on America's most basic liberty, the right to dissent and protest. With a hardy troop of about 100 others, these five citizens were on their way to a peaceful war protest at Bush's ranchette outside the town of Crawford, Texas. As their car caravan proceeded through Crawford to get to George's place, however, they were halted by an impromptu police barricade erected by Chief Donnie Tidmore. The chief told the group they could not protest in Crawford because they had no permit. "But wait," they said, "we don't plan to protest here in town. We're just passing through." They might as well have tried reasoning with a rock wall, for Tidmore was impervious to logic, saying that by driving cars containing protest signs into his town, they were engaged in a de facto demonstration. And he reminded them firmly, they had no permit for that. It was Catch-22 meets Barney Fife. Five of the group tried to talk sense to Donnie, but he was having none of it. So they were arrested, jailed, and later convicted by a Crawford jury for failing to obey Tidmore's order for them to turn around and leave town. Apparently, in Bush world, we the people have a constitutional right to assembly and free speech, but not the right to pass through Crawford to exercise those rights. But the Crawford Five refused to give in to the ludicrous law of Bush world, preferring the freedom-loving mandates laid down by America's founders. So they appealed. Gloriously, just after July 4th, the McLennan County judge presiding over the appeal dismissed all charges against the Five and restored our First Amendment rights to their proper preeminent place. This is Jim Hightower saying, stay vigilant, Americans. The forces of ignorance and arrogance are always out there to repress our liberties.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, Michael Moore says he's going to be down in Florida with my camera. Video cameras. November. Looking for signs of malfeasance on the part of old Jeb. Here's a tip, Michael. Check out a few other states. Hamilton County, Ohio just purged over 100,000 so-called felons. Michigan looks like it might be a mess. And Nebraska, of all places. Nebraska. I first wrote about this back in 2003, January 31st, 2003, a year and a half ago. And, you know, an article that was first published in Common Dreams, it's been on a whole bunch of other websites. If you want to win an election, just control the voting machines is the title of it. And pointed out that it's possible that Nebraska Republican Chuck Hagel, who has been reinventing himself marvelously, or presenting himself, let's say, marvelously as a mainstream Republican. You know, he actually is one of the few Republicans who will go on TV and criticize George Bush. Many think because he intends to run for president in 4 years. Chuck Hagel, maybe he actually honestly won two U.S. Senate elections. Maybe. But if so, there's no way to prove it. Turns out, when Chuck Hagel first ran for his U.S. Senate seat in 1996, he had just left the job of being the head of the voting machine company that counted, that was based in Nebraska, ES&S, that counted the vote in Nebraska. And when he ran in 1996, his company's computer-controlled voting machine showed he'd won stunning upsets in both the primaries and the general election. In fact, the Washington Post, January 13, 1997, said Hagel's, quote, Senate victory against an incumbent Democratic governor was the major Republican upset in the November election, end quote. According to Bev Harris of BlackBoxVoting.com, Hagel won virtually every demographic group, including many large black communities, largely black communities, that had never before voted Republican. But they were voting on his electronic voting machines. He was the first Republican in 24 years to win a Senate seat in Nebraska. In 2002, he ran again against Democrat Charlie Matulka, who I mentioned in the third hour of our program yesterday. We got into about a half-hour rant about voting machines because they are very much in the news, very much in the news. Florida election records being lost, ACLU sues Ohio over punch card ballots, fear of fraud, Paul Krugman's new article. The first Canadian city to put in computerized voting is trashing it this year, and they're one of the few that actually did it. Most of Canada votes with paper and pencil. Paper and pencil, not punch card, paper and pencil. And the St. Petersburg Times, Michael Moore is going to tackle voting rights issues in Florida. And so anyhow, I mentioned Charlie Matulka, and there's one of those strange things. You know how life is? It's just those strange things. You think about somebody and they call. I got off the air, and about an hour after I was off the air, Charlie Matulka called. And he didn't know I was talking about him, but I've got him on the phone again. Hey, Charlie. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dom, and hello, America. How are you doing today?
Great. Yeah, in fact, I didn't open the show. This is Tom Hartman. Our number 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to call in, if you have any questions for Charlie or for me or comments or whatever it may be. And Charlie, I featured you in this article almost 2 years ago now. And for a year and a half
ago. It's still going strong, by the way.
It's still getting circulated, huh?
I'm still getting about 100 letters a month from people all over the world.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, do you think that it's possible? I know you can't demonstrate that it's possible that Chuck Hagel, maybe without even knowing it. I mean, you know, maybe somebody in the company, maybe some hacker got it. You know, they're saying today these machines are not secure. This technology, this was 8 years ago.
Yeah, and it hasn't been secure since 1968.
Yeah, so do you think it's possible that somebody kind of cracked in and that Chuck Hagel didn't actually win that first election? Or the second?
Well, I think it's absolutely strongly possible. When you want to look at some just the basic facts, election systems and software out of Omaha, Nebraska, it's one of the largest vote counting companies in the world.
Yeah.
Yet alone in the United States. Now, they're going to count between 60 and 65% of the Bush vote with no paper trail. In the presidential race, there's going to be over 80% of all the votes with Diebold and ES&S. They're going to control the whole voting process with no paper trail, and that means 80% of all the votes are going to be cast by voodoo cyberspace tabulation
now,
with no paper trail.
And now,
this is just ludicrous.
And this is the company that was headed up by current United States Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, who you ran against 3 years
yes.
ago in the 2002 election. And in fact, his website says that he was reelected to his second term in the United States Senate on November 5th, 2002, with 83% of the vote, which represents the biggest political victory in the history of Nebraska. You think it's square, Charlie?
Well, like you said, 2 years ago, a lot of people thought it was square. But as more and more people find out the truth about this radical right-wing takeover of public elections, they have successfully privatized the elections process. In the meantime, no one can be held accountable because you can't sue cyberspace tabulation.
Yeah.
They own the software, and he who owns the software owns the election. It's that basic, and the American people deserve better, and that's why I'm here today.
There you go. Well, in fact, our quote for the day from Joseph Stalin, usually quoting American historical figures, but Joseph Stalin said something that was perhaps prescient.
Very good.
He said, those who cast the votes decide nothing. Those who count the votes decide everything.
Everything. And it's really, it's that true, and it's just about that time when they had some of the technology to do this.
Yeah.
But I just want to go on to say is that I strongly believe from the bottom of my heart, I have nobody's paying me to say this or not to say this, I believe that we uncovered a massive election fraud scandal, and it's been happening for some time, but now it's hit rock bottom, and we must always use the 2000 presidential bushwhacking in 2000 in Florida. We must realize that the election process was hijacked there, and no one could defend that. And this is why Iran and then 9/11. We must change our ways, and like I said, the American people have been hoodwinked one too many times, and this cover-up must stop now.
Yeah, I agree. I want to ask you in just a minute about the law that was passed in Nebraska that makes it illegal for citizens to ask for a recount on electronic machines. But first, let's take a call here, 1-866-889-8894. Dave in Humboldt County, California, is on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up? What's your question?
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. You know, to me, a couple of points, but one is that the fact that legislation has been introduced in both the House and the Senate calling for verifiable voting machines, and the fact that Tom DeLay has prevented, blocked that from coming to a vote, that to me is conclusive evidence that these same folks that hijacked the last election fully planned to try to rig the next one. Why else would he not have let...
Yeah, this being Rush Holt's bill, the one that he has so many co-sponsors
for.
Yeah,
and Ron Wyden also had one in the Senate, and any number of co-authors that are asking.
Yeah. Charlie Matulka, have you had anything to do with this bill that's, that Rush Holt is putting forward? Have they talked with you about it or anything like that?
Yes, I've talked to Mr. Holt on several occasions, and I sent him some correspondence to him to let him know about the problem here in Nebraska and nationwide.
Yeah.
And he's well aware of what's going on. I'm well aware of his bill that he tried to get pushed through, and some Republican that's head of the board is trying to stop it. But
yeah,
we're not asking for nothing different. These machines back in the 80s should have been equipped with voter verified paper trails.
Yeah.
And the state cannot certify cyberspace results of the election alone. They have to have a paper trail, something visual, to make it legally and constitutionally viable.
Yeah, and Rush Holt for his bill, for his piece of legislation that would require that these machines produce a voter, a ballot, produce an actual ballot that could be counted after the fact if a dispute ever came up. He has enough co-sponsors for that bill, Democrats and Republicans together, that to pass it. He has a majority of Congress as co-sponsors, and Tom DeLay will not allow it to come to the floor for a vote. And, you know, this is the point that Dave's making. Anyhow, Dave, your question. Let's get right to it.
Clearly calls for an extraordinary measure that we here as the citizens of the United States are watching these Halliburton, Bechtel hijack our White House, hijack our elections. It calls for measures that there is no provision for. Nobody ever. We've had some excellent presidents in the history of this country, but nothing like this has ever happened. It calls for some extraordinary measure.
Dave, I think that the measure that it calls for is not so much that we need to do something, but we need to undo something. In 1978, in the Boston versus Bilotti Supreme Court decision, the United States Supreme Court said there was a law. There was a law in Massachusetts that said that a corporation cannot buy political advertising for things that have nothing to do with it. And the First National Bank of Boston was buying advertising, and Frank Bilotti, I believe Frank was his first name, was the attorney general, and he sued them, and he said, you can't do that. And they took it to the Supreme Court, and they said, hey, we're a corporation. We think we're a person. We should have free speech rights. We should have First Amendment rights. And because we don't have a mouth, a corporation doesn't have a mouth, it's not a living being, even though they're claiming that they're a person, our money is our speech. And oddly enough, the United States Supreme Court agreed. Now, the Warren Court back in LBJ's day wouldn't have agreed with that. The court that Franklin Delano Roosevelt stacked so that he could, you know, reverse the Supreme Court decisions of 1913, making minimum wage laws, child labor laws unconstitutional, wouldn't have agreed with that. I'd say, you know, courts going quite a ways back, probably Morris Remick Waite's court in 1886 wouldn't have agreed with that. But the court in 1978 agreed with that. And this is why it is so critical. We've got the next president of the United States is going to nominate at least three, probably four and maybe even five, but at least three members of the United States Supreme Court. And this is and what needs to be done is to reverse that Supreme Court decision. Because that Supreme Court decision in 1978 was what kicked open the door for Ronald Reagan and his corporate buddies to come in 1980 and begin the hijacking of the American middle class and the destruction of the American middle class. Charlie, we've got about 30 seconds before we got to say it again. Go ahead, Charlie.
Also, they're destroying our Constitution and our civil liberties, such as the Patriot Act.
Yeah. Step by step. I mean, it's like this is the con takeover of the United States. By the way, Dave, thanks for calling. Our number 1-866-889-8894. If you have thoughts, comments, questions, want to vent, whatever. And we're talking with Charlie Matulka, who in 2002 was the Democratic candidate for the United States Senate from the great state of Nebraska, and was beaten by Chuck Hagel, who, it turns out, was head of ES&S, the voting machine company that counted the vote in Nebraska. Strange goings on. Stick around. We'll be right back with Charlie. Hang on, Charlie. We've got to take a break here. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report.
The latest figures from the Federal Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation say the number of underfunded pension plans dropped last year by 9%. About 1,050 pensions are collectively short some $279 billion, yet the report doesn't paint a complete picture. It only covers pension funds, which are $50 million or more in the red, and conveniently overlooks the massive underfunding that's taken place since 1999.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the project for the new American century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Ball said after reading We the People.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
He used to carry his guitar in a gunny sack. Go sit beneath the tree by the railroad track.
Johnny, be good. We got a couple of Johnnies here running for president and vice president. Good song there, eh, Charlie?
I love it.
Yeah. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. We're talking with Charlie Matulko, candidate for the United States Senate in the year 2002 from the great state of Nebraska, running against Chuck Hagel. Later discovered Chuck Hagel had been the president of the company based in Nebraska, one of the largest voting machine companies in America, that owned and manufactured the voting machines used in Nebraska. Charlie, let me just play a clip here for our listeners. Real quick, this is from last night's Democratic National Convention. Al Sharpton talking about the importance of the vote and why this is worth fighting for.
Mr. President, the reason we are fighting so hard, the reason we took Florida so seriously, is our right to vote wasn't gained because of our age. Our vote was soaked in the blood of martyrs, soaked in the blood of Goodman, Cheney, and Sumner, soaked in the blood of four little girls in Birmingham. This vote is sacred to us. This vote can't be bargained away. This vote can't be given away.
And one would hope it can't be stolen by electronic machines, Al Sharpton adds, a little postscript here.
Mr. President, in all due respect, Mr. President, read my lips. Our vote is not for sale.
There you go. We're going to have a lot more of Al Sharpton here today. That was a barn burner, but I don't want to digress from that for another 5 minutes here. I just want to wrap this thing up. We're talking with Charlie Matulko. Charlie, in Nebraska, one of the first things the Republicans did when they won this landslide victory all across the state for the first year that they were using the electronic voting machines statewide, apparently, is they passed a law. What was that law?
They passed a law by the Secretary of State. They passed a law to where they eliminated, it was in 2002, in LB 1054 in the Nebraska statutes. For all the media and press out there, this is how you can look it up, 2002, LB 1054, and also Statute 32-1119, number 6. It successfully eliminates the manual recount provision for any precinct which reflects any substantial change during a machine recount. Now, this would appear to eliminate the exposed flank for a private contractor controlling the vote counting process.
Yeah, let's just put this in a
electronic programming.
Charlie, let's put this in plain English. It means that it's against the law if the vote is counted on electronic voting machines to recount the vote, right?
Yeah, you have no recourse. So they successfully eliminated the only paper trail, the only safeguard to detect or prove fraud. Yeah. Well, this is a...
This is incredible.
I was born in the dark, but I wasn't born last night.
There you go. Now, Charlie, we've only got a minute and a half or so here left. There's a major newspaper in Nebraska, and you tried to take your story to them. You had some concerns about the vote. What happened?
Well, they pretty much they wouldn't talk to anybody. They wouldn't give up anything. They told us they were a family-owned newspaper, and I said, "Well, what business do you own ownership of the one of the largest voting machine companies in America?" And they denied it. And also, another co-conspirator in this election fraud scheme is Hagel's treasurer.
Yeah,
but McCarthy.
But before we get into that, they denied that they owned that the newspaper owned part of the voting machine company. But
first, yeah.
Oh, but later they admitted it.
Yeah, later they finally admitted it, and they put a little track in the paper way at the bottom of the page, and basically that's all we ever heard about. And then all the news reporters, all the journalists, they cannot talk about the subject. It's off limits.
And this is the largest newspaper in the state.
Cover up.
This is the largest newspaper in the state.
Yeah, and it's one of the largest companies in the world.
Wow. Okay. It's amazing. Charlie, real quickly, is there a
world companies?
Yeah, is there a website where people can find more information?
There are several websites out there. One is Black Box Voting.
BlackBoxVoting.com. Right.
And another one is ecotalk.org. It's ecotalk.
.org. Okay. Charlie Matalka, Charlie, thank you so much for being with us. We got a boogie here, but I really appreciate it. And we're going to have you on again here right soon.
Well, yeah, this is going to heat up, and we must do our constitutional right, and we must protect the American people at all costs.
There you go.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com. Or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
According to an internal memo, government workers at the nation's airports are constantly subjected to abuse and extreme stress. The memo, written by Marcia Florian, the federal security director in Phoenix, Arizona, and obtained by the Seattle Times, says screeners have endured false promises from hiring contractors, weeks or months with no pay or benefits, mandatory conversion to part-time, forced overtime, and now a recertification process that shows no regard for screener morale, effectiveness, or livelihood. The Times interviewed more than 100 current or former Transportation Security Administration employees who verified multiple abuses. The Department of Homeland Security placed Florian on administrative leave Tuesday morning.
The International Professional and Technical Engineers have members concentrated in the swing states of Pennsylvania and Washington. IFPTE Legislative Political Director Matt Biggs has seen firsthand how the Bush administration's policies hurt labor.
With respect to the Department of Homeland Security, when he created that, he aimed to gut union rights, and he did that, as well as civil service protections that federal employees historically enjoy. And his latest maneuver is through the Department of Defense, which employs 720,000 federal civil servants nationwide. The President and Secretary Rumsfeld are aiming to completely gut the collective bargaining, the pay structures, the veterans' preference, and EEOC protections, among other things, of the 720,000 federal civil servants employed by DOD. So it was pretty much a no-brainer. Senator Kerry's record on all of these issues, by the way, is stellar.
The clock is ticking as the World Trade Organization tries to hammer out the framework for trade talks by the end of the week. Last year's WTO conference in Cancun, Mexico imploded amid deep rifts between rich and poor countries. The discussions, currently being held in Geneva, are an attempt to mend those rifts. However, the organization is already walking a thin line, as African nations have expressed they will not sign anything unless their concerns about subsidies paid to cotton farmers in rich countries, namely the United States, are addressed. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Depending on whose statistics you choose, the unemployment rate in Iraq runs between 28 and 50%. For a proper perspective on this catastrophe, the unemployment rate in the United States during the Great Depression peaked at 25%, and the situation is getting worse. Iraqi construction firms have been cut out of all but the smallest rebuilding projects, and American contractors are importing cheap labor from Pakistan and India instead of giving the work to Iraqis who desperately need it.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Slinger riding on the range. I'm white educated and I can't affect any change. Strange as it sounds to me.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Our website, www.tomhartman.com. Last night, boy, some fireworks at the Democratic National, or the Democratic Convention. That's also the National Convention. The DNC of the DNC, as it were. And one of the highlights of the evening, there were a couple of real... John Edwards said a couple of things that I thought were really worth expounding on. But by and large, it was, you know, basically the speech that we all expected. But there were a couple of parts that I want to share with you as we go through the program. But I thought the real barn burner was Al Sharpton. And Dennis Kucinich did a marvelous job. I've got some clips from both that I want to share with you. They raise these issues that point out how most Americans don't even know our history. They don't even know what's going on. Here, let me just start off with this one here.
We are here 282 years after, right here in Boston, we fought.
And now, as he said that, I was sitting there hearing this African-American man say 282 years after, right here in Boston, we fought. And there was just a moment, you know, I'm going, wait a minute. And then he said, you know, because the stereotype that most people have, and you know, it's amazing, because I just finished all this research for this, and I knew this, but I didn't know. It's like we get, because it caught me for a second. And he goes on to tell the truth, the actual story here.
To establish the freedoms of America. The first person to die in the Revolutionary War, buried not far from here, a black man from Barbados named Crispus Attucks.
Crispus Attucks. See, this was on March 5th, 1700, 3 years before the Boston Tea Party. And most historians suggest that this was the event that really kicked off the American Revolution. There was the redcoats were everywhere. The British soldiers were, you know, the increasing their presence. The colonists were getting more and more restive. The British East India Company was getting more and more aggressive. The one piece that you don't find in most history books that really was a big chunk of what was going on was that there was a very, very, very bad economic, essentially disaster that happened in the late 1760s through the early 1770s. So they were going through a period, about a 10 or 15 year period, that was not quite a Great Depression, but was rough. And the East India Company was suffering under it as well. And that's why they went to the Queen, who was one of their major, or the King rather, at that time. They had been chartered by Queen Elizabeth I in 1601. But anyhow, they went to the King. King George III, who was one of the major stockholders in the company, as were most of the members of Parliament. They went to him and said, we would like a tax cut, much like, you know, Halliburton went to the government during the Clinton administration, said, we'd like a tax cut. Here's some money. Give a lot of money to the legislators. The Republicans controlled the Congress at the time. They're the ones who write tax legislation. Said, here's some money. We'd like some tax breaks, please. And the largest corporations in America went from paying taxes to actually getting tax refunds for the last few years of the 20th century, and continuing to in many cases. But anyhow, this was going on. The British East India Company, this was the Tea Act of 1773. That's what led to the Boston Tea Party. And it's just people forget, or many people, I think, don't even realize that in 1776, there were in Massachusetts and in many states in the North, and even in the South to some extent, but very rare, frankly, but certainly in the North, there were African Americans who were free and who were citizens. And people say, well, you know, the founders wrote the Constitution in a way that they didn't want blacks and women to vote. Wrong. Wrong. The Constitution does not say that you must be white to vote. That was something that several states had, those laws, particularly in the South, but not in the North. There were African Americans who were voting, and there were women who were voting after the Constitution was ratified in the 1780s, the 1790s, the 1800s. And what happened was that progressively, or regressively, I suppose you could say, but, you know, moving like a tide from the south to the north, states started passing laws making it illegal for African Americans to vote and for women to vote, and taking away the rights of women, economic rights, political rights, right across the board. So from Dred Scott to 1896, Ferguson, I'm missing the name anyhow, that Supreme case all the way up to 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, which was when, you know, by and large, the Supreme Court finally said, you know, no more, absolutely no more. And then of course, the Voting Rights Act and all these steps along the way. Most of this all had to do with the federal government going to states and saying, no, you cannot suppress the vote. Jefferson was very upset about this, by the way, Thomas Jefferson. I just finished 4 years of just like living inside his letters, which produced this book, What Would Jefferson Do, which Amazon just started shipping yesterday. And his correspondence is extraordinary on this topic. He goes on and on and on about the evils of slavery. You say, well, wait a minute, he was a slaveholder. Yes, and the first piece of legislation that he submitted when he became a legislator in Virginia was a bill to end slavery. It was defeated. In fact, they punished him by passing a law that made it nearly impossible for Virginia slaveholders to free their slaves without their slaves immediately being captured by others. Fawn Brody points out in her biography of Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson and Intimate History, it deserves notice that his phrase, all men born free, which appeared 6 years later in the Declaration of Independence, and which has been traced with such zealous scholarship to men of the Enlightenment, first came to his lips publicly in the legal defense of a black man when he was a lawyer, Thomas Jefferson. The case was Howell versus Netherland in 1770 when he was passing law. And he was arguing on behalf of a slave who he felt should be freed. And he said, under the law of nature, all men are born free, and everyone comes into the world with a right to his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it at his own will. In 1769 was when he tried to ban slavery in Virginia. 1774 he wrote about it. 1776, when he was asked to write the Declaration of Independence, he wrote a paragraph into it condemning slavery. John Adams and Ben Franklin made him take it out. That was the editing process. 1778, he proposed an even more radical bill which would have abolished slavery altogether in Virginia. 1783, he tried unsuccessfully to amend the Virginia Constitution with language that said, and I quote, "The General Assembly should not permit the introduction of any more slaves to reside in the state or the continuance of slavery beyond the generation which shall be living on the 31st day of December 1800, all persons born after that date hereby being declared free." It's actually written into the Constitution, or at least Jefferson thought it was written into the Constitution, that slavery would end in 1808. Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution reads, "The migration or importation of such persons," which was the phrase that they used to refer to African Americans, "as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit, shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. So back in the 1770s and 1780s, Jefferson over and over wrote that slavery is going to end in 1808. That's going to be it. And ironically, he was president in 1808, and he couldn't get this thing through. And it just ripped him apart. It just ripped him apart in his older age, as it were. Well, this is about 6 years before he died. He wrote a letter to Benjamin Rush, a friend of his, about a treason against the hope of the world, which was slavery in his mind. He said, "I regret that I am now to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves by the generation of 1776 to acquire self-government and happiness to their country is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons, and that my only consolation is to be that I will live not to weep over it. If they would but dispassionately weigh the blessings they will throw away against an abstract principle, that being the principle of slavery, more likely to be affected by union than by scission, that I would pause before they would permit this act of suicide on themselves and of treason against the hopes of the world. He was specifically in that letter just absolutely flipped out about the deal out west, the Missouri and Maine thing. This is in 1820. Missouri and Maine were being admitted to the Union, and Congress cut a deal where they said, okay, Missouri can be a slave state. And Congressman John Holmes of Massachusetts wrote a letter to Jefferson on April 20th, 1820, 6 years before his death, telling him about this. And Jefferson replied to him. In it, he foresaw a day when the nation would be torn apart across a geographical line. This is Jefferson seeing the Mason-Dixon line, right? Seeing the end of... He says, I thank you, dear sir, for the copy you've been so kind to send me the letter of your constituents on the Missouri question. It is a perfect justification to them. I had for a long time ceased to read newspapers. You know, he goes on, he's confident that they were in good hands and content to be a passenger in our bark to the shore from which I am not distant. But this momentous question, the question of the continuance of slavery after 1808, this momentous question, like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I considered it at once as the knell, the death knell of the Union. It is hushed indeed for the moment, but this is a reprieve. The it he's talking about is the backlash of slavery. But this is a reprieve only, not a final sentence, a geographical line coinciding with a marked principle. That being the principle of slavery, moral and political, once conceived and held up to the angry passions of men, will never be obliterated, and every new irritation will mark it deeper and deeper. I can say, Jefferson wrote, with conscious truth, that there is not a man on earth who would sacrifice more than I would to relieve us from this heavy reproach in any practicable way. The cessation of that kind of property, for it is so misnamed, is a bagatelle. It's a trifle. They would not cost me a second thought if in any way a general emancipation and extirpation could be effected, and gradually and with due sacrifices I think it might be. But as it is, we have the wolf by the ears, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice is on one side and self-preservation on the other. Very, very difficult time. Very difficult time. So anyhow, Al Sharpton... waking us up to our history of the past, and then talking about our present, our standing in the world, and what has happened to it.
But let me quickly say, this is not just about winning an election. It's about preserving the principles on which this very nation was founded. Look at the current view of our nation worldwide as a result of our unilateral foreign policy. We went from unprecedented international support and solidarity on September 12, 2001, to hostility and hatred as we stand here tonight. We can't survive in the world by ourselves.
Very, very straightforward. I mean, this is a brilliant speech.
How did we squander this opportunity to unite the world for democracy and to commit to the global fight against hunger and disease? We did it with a go-it-alone foreign policy based on flawed intelligence. We were told that we were going to Iraq because there were weapons of mass destruction. We lost hundreds of soldiers. We spent $200 billion at a time we had record state deficits. And when it became clear that there were no weapons, they changed the premise for the war and said, no, we went because of other reasons.
And then Sharpton says, he gives a great example, you know, I'll just let him.
If I told you tonight to let's leave the fleet center, we're in danger. And when you get outside, you ask me, Reverend Al, what is the danger? And I say, it don't matter, we just needed some fresh air. I have misled you, and we were misled.
And we were misled. And that, you know, the bottom line there. And these very real, very large issues, and I want to get into, and particularly in the next hour of the show, the issue of what is morality, how does conservative and liberal morality, in quotes, differ. What is the essential and core debate really going on here? 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Michael in Santa Fe is on the line. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I don't know if you know this, but Al Sharpton, he submitted a six-minute speech to the DNC.
I know, and he ran 20.
And scrapped it and got up there and said what he wanted to say.
Yeah, I thought it was wonderful.
Did you hear about that?
Yeah. Yeah, everybody heard about that, Michael.
I didn't know that. I just heard about that. I wonder if Dennis Kucinich did the same thing. So I thought that was great.
Yeah.
You know, so I forgive him for having Republican operatives run his campaign.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. Let's not go there right now. But good
thanks.
Point. Michael, thanks for the call. So Dennis Kucinich, in fact, made an excellent point. The real weapons of mass destruction. And I don't have time right now to play that whole clip, but we will get to it. But Kucinich's point, and this is such an urgent one, such an important one, is that the conservative idea of morality is private morality. What you should do in your bedroom, or what I should do in mine. That's the conservative idea. The liberal idea of morality includes that, but also has a larger frame which says what we should do. As long as any is hungry among us, we cannot call ourselves moral. We'll get back to that in a minute. Tom Hartman with you, 10 minutes before the hour.
Tom Hartman will be speaking out in Santa Fe, New Mexico with We the People, a call to take back America, a Friday evening talk August 27th at the Santa Fe Armory for the Arts, to be followed by a Saturday, August 28th workshop called Waking Up to Personal and Global Transformation. Tom Hartman brings his wit, wisdom, and intelligence to Santa Fe the weekend of August 27th and 28th. Tom Hartman will discuss with us how America faces its greatest threat since a civil war. And Tom Hartman will look at how Western thinking, legends, and myths have caused global problems and endangered democracy and what we can do about it. To get your tickets and more information, call 505-988-2223 in Santa Fe. That's 505-988-2223 or visit greatmystery.org. Tickets for Tom Hartman are also available at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me this October as we explore Greece, the ancient birthplace of democracy. When the Founding Fathers were searching for the best and fairest form of government, they studied the models of Athenian democracy. We'll explore together this part of the ancient world where the ideas that today animate modern democracy were first worked out. This journey is set on the shore of the sparkling Mediterranean Sea with the sacred mountains of Crete behind us. We'll visit the ancient site of Gortian, famous for the Law Code of Gortian, large 6th century BC tablets of stone built into a wall and one of the first examples of laws ever written down and now the oldest still in existence. I'll teach workshops at the two most important sites in all of Crete, Knossos and Phaistos, plus more. At Knossos, we'll experience the main ceremonial center and the palace of King Minos. For information on how you can join us on this trip of a lifetime, visit www.tomhartman.com or call 1-800-234-TOUR. That's 1-800-234-TOUR, T-O-U-R.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Children who get lots of exercise risk poor health if they breathe polluted air. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Couch potatoes are in some ways healthier than kids who play soccer, run, or participate in other outdoor sports if they live in areas with high levels of air pollution. Kent Bransford is a medical doctor and a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, an advocacy group. He cites a recent study of children living in Southern California.
what they did is take children all growing up in the same bad air area, and then they divided them into two groups. One group, very active, playing outside like we probably want our kids to do. So if they were in three or more sports during the year, they were in the active group. And then the other half of the kids were living in the same area but more sedentary. So inside, playing with their Game Boys and PlayStations, etc.
Bransford says the results were surprising.
What was very worrisome is that the children that were outside, active, playing, breathing a lot of air, which children do more so for their body weight than adults, they had about a threefold increase risk of developing asthma compared to the kids who were not as active.
Another recent study looked at California college freshmen. It focused on students who had similar activity levels but compared where they grew up. Bransford says those from Southern California, where smog levels are highest, had more lung disorders than kids from Northern California, where the air is better.
Those college freshmen had decreased lung function studies at age 18, purely related on where they grew up and the air they breathe.
Bransford says air pollution can cause health problems that might last a lifetime. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by the Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research, www.cascr.org. Futurist Benjamin Krim, 888-242-8272. And Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Amazing song. Dennis Kucinich was one of the other, I think, really sparkling speakers last night. And let me just share with you this quick piece.
We are here 282
Whoa.
Years.
Whoops. Pushed the wrong
after
button.
Right
hang
here
on
in Boston,
just a second. Here we go.
We fought.
Okay, this is the right one.
This administration rushed us into a war based on distortions and misrepresentations. We must hold them accountable.
And then he talks about the real weapons of mass destruction. This was just a singular moment for me.
Iraq. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11 or with Al-Qaeda's role in 9/11. We have found no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
But there are some here.
I was mayor of Cleveland, and I can tell you that I've seen weapons of mass destruction in our cities. Poverty is a weapon of mass destruction. Joblessness is a weapon of mass destruction. Homelessness, a weapon of mass destruction. Racism, a weapon of mass destruction. Fear, a weapon of mass destruction. We must disarm these weapons.
And that's just, I mean, it just boils right down to that. Do you consider an aspect, a dimension of morality to be, we are all in this together, or do you think that the most moral statement is, you know, get what you can, it's every man for himself? And that's the divide between progressives or, you know, the average, between the historic vision of America that was put together by the founders, that there is a common, there is a commonwealth. In fact, they named, you know, state the Commonwealth of Kentucky, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, that there is a commons that we are all mutually responsible for, and that the weakest and most vulnerable among us are part of that, and that without interdependence, we're in deep trouble. And the cons just completely toss this out. Anyhow, Tom Hartman with you, The True People's Radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
According to an internal memo, government workers at the nation's airports are constantly subjected to abuse and extreme stress. The memo, written by Marcia Florian, the federal security director in Phoenix, Arizona, and obtained by the Seattle Times, says screeners have endured false promises from hiring contractors, weeks or months with no pay or benefits, mandatory conversion to part-time, forced overtime, and now a recertification process that shows no regard for screener morale, effectiveness, or livelihood. The Times interviewed more than 100 current or former Transportation Security Administration employees who verified multiple abuses. The Department of Homeland Security placed Florian on administrative leave Tuesday morning.
The International Professional and Technical Engineers have members concentrated in the swing states of Pennsylvania and Washington. IFPTE Legislative Political Director Matt Biggs has seen firsthand how the Bush administration's policies hurt labor.
With respect to the Department of Homeland Security, when he created that, he aimed to gut union rights, and he did that, as well as civil service protections that federal employees historically enjoy. And his latest maneuver is through the Department of Defense, which employs 720,000 federal civil servants nationwide. The President and Secretary Rumsfeld are aiming to completely gut the collective bargaining, the pay structures, the veterans' preference, and EEOC protections, among other things, of the 720,000 federal civil servants employed by DOD. So it was pretty much a no-brainer. Senator Kerry's record on all of these issues, by the way, is stellar.
The clock is ticking as the World Trade Organization tries to hammer out the framework for trade talks by the end of the week. Last year's WTO conference in Cancun, Mexico, imploded amid deep rifts between rich and poor countries. The discussions, currently being held in Geneva, are an attempt to mend those rifts. However, the organization is already walking a thin line, as African nations have expressed they will not sign anything unless their concerns about subsidies paid to cotton farmers in rich countries, namely the United States, are addressed. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Depending on whose statistics you choose, the unemployment rate in Iraq runs between 28 and 50%. For a proper perspective on this catastrophe, the unemployment rate in the United States during the Great Depression peaked at 25%, and the situation is getting worse. Iraqi construction firms have been cut out of all but the smallest rebuilding projects, and American contractors are importing cheap labor from Pakistan and India instead of giving the work to Iraqis who desperately need it.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send your job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in recovery. Then after a year, you finally land another job, and you wonder, Is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
After years of studious analysis and sober reflection, I've come to this measured conclusion about the Bushites. These people are nuts. When I presented this blunt conclusion in my latest book, Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush, several peers of establishment punditry said, "Oh, Hightower, surely you don't mean nuts. Robust corporatists, yes. Even exuberant empire builders for their conservative worldview. But surely Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft, Rumsfeld, and company are not, you know, extremists who would try to superimpose their own Orwellian, Strangelovian, Ayn Randian, Jerry Falwellian ideology over America's democratic ideals and institutions, right? Wrong. They're insane. Loopy zealots fueled by their own extremist fumes to implement their plutocratic, autocratic, imperialistic vision of America. And it's time we stop beating around the bush about it. From a stolen election in Florida to elitist tax giveaways for the rich, from a war of lies in Iraq to a culture of repression in the homeland, the Bushites are willing to break all the rules, laws, and notions of public trust to have their way and remake America in their corporatist image. The latest example of this is their legal maneuvering to, get this, give them the executive power to postpone this fall's presidential elections. I know, you're thinking, come on, Hightower, even they're not that nutty. But yes, they are. Homeland Czar Tom Ridge has asked legal schemers to produce a doomsday scenario under which the national election could be put off in the event of, say, a code red terrorist alert issued by, who else, Ridge's own department. We are considering what steps need to be taken to secure the election, said a Homeland spokesman. This is Jim Hightower saying, not even in the Civil War or in the madness of the McCarthyism scare was it even suggested by top officials that elections be suspended. That's how nutty the Bushites are. I'm Jim Hightower, and I've approved this message.
Jim Hightower is not running for office, but he is back this campaign season with an important word about the regime of King George V.
Let's stop beating around the bush. These people are nuts.
Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is Hightower's hilarious new best-selling book, offering you unvarnished facts, insight, and humor to get you through this year's political spin cycle. Buy Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush today and make politics fun again. Available at bookstores everywhere and on the web at jimhightower.com. Buy it today.
America is a country of entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner, you're helping shoulder the lion's share of the U.S. economy. You can lighten that load a little at Sam's Club. When you shop at Sam's Club, you get everyday low costs on products you need every day. After all, while you may be carrying around the weight of the American economy, you shouldn't have to do all the heavy lifting by yourself. Join the club. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman with you. Let's go back to the Democratic Convention in Boston, right across the harbor from where the ship that carried the tea in December of 1773 got trashed. Oddly, the ship has vanished. There's a little plaque there that says, we're sorry, the ship isn't available, the Boston Tea Party boat. Nobody's sure why exactly. But anyhow, here's just a short clip. Actually, before I get to that, let's just take a quick call here. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. John in Santa Fe is on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make a point about the November election and how crucial turnout is, you know, assuming the votes are counted correctly.
Yeah.
That in the last election, what was turnout? Maybe 52-53%, somewhere in there? Does that sound about right?
I don't recall, but that's the general range that we usually see, yeah.
I'm thinking there's probably a threshold. Let's say if turnout is 57-58% or 60%, once it gets up that way, it's almost an assured carry victory.
Well, it could be. I mean, the cons are, you know, they're passing out all this stuff to the churches. They sent out a mailing now to 13 or 14,000 churches in the United States asking that they submit to the Republican National Committee, or to the Bush campaign, rather, a list of all the members of their church so that they can solicit them. I mean, these guys have a lot of money and are really well organized, and they've got a massive get out the vote campaign going. So it's happening on both sides.
I guess hopefully what I'm thinking is that the 45% of the people who don't vote, their interests primarily would be with the Democrats, you know, if they voted their interests.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I don't know of any really good studies that have been done on that. And by the way, by saying that the Republicans are trying to get the churches out to vote, it raises the idea in some people's minds that people who go to church always vote Republican, which definitely is not the case. But the churches that are, you know, there are so many churches now that are overtly political, both left and right. You know, the Unitarian Universalists, you know, I'm sure that they're working, well, they're probably not, because they want to preserve their tax-exempt status. But if they were to become politically active, they would probably be working for Kerry or for, you know, some third-party candidate. But in any case, I'm meandering. What were you going to say, John?
That was basically it, just a point about turnout.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is going to be really interesting to watch. Thanks for the call, John. I appreciate it. 10 minutes after the hour, it's really going to be interesting to watch how this thing plays out. John Edwards last night had some thoughts. Again, going back to this issue of what is morality. How do we define morality? From the founding of this country, even before the founding of this country, up until roughly the mid-1980s, morality was broadly agreed to in the United States. And now you could argue that there was a little blip during the Gilded Age, 1880, 1890, up until, you know, 1920, 29. But even that, I'd say that would be a pretty tough argument to make, because even then, the idea was still solid. So I think I can safely argue that from even before the founding of this country up until the mid-1980s, pretty much everybody understood that a key component of morality in a society, that if we are moral people, then it has something to do with those things. For example, those who are religious could point to Matthew 25, Jesus saying, you know, the only way to get into heaven is if you feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit those in prison, care for the sick. And that as you've done to the least among these, you've done to me. Or the Jewish notion of tikkun, that we are all born with the obligation to heal the world. And there are similar ideas in all the major religions of the world. So, you know, there's that clear notion that, you know, this is what morality is. Or what started with Ayn Rand's novel, Atlas Shrugged, in the 1950s, became a cult in the 1960s and grew to subsume the conservative movement in the 70s and 80s, and now is promoted by the right-wing talk machine all across America, the idea that morality within a society is really only defined by the individual getting theirs, and screw everybody else. If they're not tough enough to make it to the top, they didn't deserve to be there. Bloody, bloody, blah. And you know, there's a middle ground here that says, you know, we acknowledge that there is a morality. Let me just give you this real quick clip of John Edwards. Then we got a couple of calls here. We'll get into a discussion of this. John Edwards last night talking about morality.
Also, we can also do something about 35 million Americans who live in poverty every day. And here's why we shouldn't just talk about, but do something about the millions of Americans who live in poverty. Because it is wrong. And we have a moral responsibility to lift those families up.
Now, you won't hear that from the Republicans, because the cons have a different idea of morality. He continues.
I mean, the very idea that in a country of our wealth and our prosperity, we have children going to bed hungry, We have children who don't have the clothes to keep them warm. We have millions of Americans who work full-time every day to support their families, working for minimum wage, and still live in poverty. It's wrong. These are men and women who are living up to their bargain. They're working hard. They're supporting their families. Their families are doing their part. It's time we did our part.
And that's the idea of the social contract, that we enter into this contract with society. If you do your role, you'll be appropriately, you know, a place in society. He continues.
And that's what we're going to do. That's what we're going to do when John is in the White House, because we're going to raise the minimum wage. We're going to finish the job on welfare reform. And we're going to bring good-paying jobs to the places where we need them the most. And by doing all those things, we're going to say no forever to any American working full-time and living in poverty. Not in our America. Not in our America. Not in our America.
Just a simple article of faith, an absolute, just clear statement. This is how I see the world. 1-866-889-8894. Paul in Eureka, California, on the line. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to give you I've heard some talk about LaRouche, and I've never heard anything positive. And I'd like to give you my positive impression of his ideas and hear your response.
Okay.
Basically, the reason why I like what LaRouche says is because he is promoting the idea of the fact that all human freedom is based on the idea of scientific and technological progress, that this scientific and technological progress is for the common good of all humanity, and that basically he says that that what's popular culture has come to reflect in academia as far as the idea of existentialism in philosophy, abstract impressionism in the arts, and is really. And the idea of free market economics is basically a Malthusian ideology based on, you know, struggle, you know, like a Darwinian law of the jungle.
Yeah.
And that we need to go back to the idea of classical Greek humanistic culture.
Yeah, well, except that you know, I know nothing about Lyndon LaRouche except that, you know, his legal problems and the fact that a lot of people think he's a weird cult leader.
Well, I thought you said you read a lot of his stuff.
No,
you don't have any comments on anything?
I have not. I really do. I've never read anything by Lyndon, well, not in 15 or 20 years anyway.
Well, basically what I've read is basically his ideas of economics or the idea of FDR basically... He sees FDR as an extension of the ideas of Hamilton and then Lincoln.
Well,
the idea of creating a national banking system, which was how this country was originally set up, so that the credit would be in the hands of the people and democratically applied instead of the hands of a few multinationals.
Well, you know, that's great. If that's, you know, I just, you know, I can't, Paul, I can't discuss Lyndon LaRouche with you when I'm not other than all the negative press, which we've all heard.
See, that's
pretty much all I know.
Yeah,
about.
I see people going bananas and saying what a terrible guy is, but never really giving an idea of why his ideas are bad.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've given him a plug, and people can check him out on the web. I'm sure he's, you know, Google him or something, and you'll find it. Thanks, Paul, for the call. 1-866-889-8894. Tomas in Grand Rapids is on the line. Hey, Tomas, what's up?
Hey, thanks for the opportunity. You know,
sure.
I'll be saying hi to my man Bush when he comes over here.
Oh my.
In a couple of hours. But what I wanted to ask you is, what are we going to do with the borders of this country? If both parties, you know, both parties in their own way are going to say they want to help the poor and they want to have better paying jobs. And I believe the report came out today that said income fell 2001 and 2002. The IRS came out with something on.
And 2003. Yeah, income has been falling for three years and corporate profits have been up. You know,
but if you keep letting, you know, 3 million people come in every year across the borders and through the ports, and especially in a time of war, how is that going to, you know, help us create better jobs?
Yeah, well, this is where I part company with some quote liberals, and that is that I really think that every country, I guess in some ways I'm a a populist slash nationalist. I really believe that every country needs to collectively decide how they want to conduct their affairs and conduct them that way, and that when you've got people from who are fleeing the failure of a country, pouring over the borders into another country, it creates a disaster. I mean, you see this all over the world where you have, I mean, I've worked in situations where you've got refugees fleeing, you know, coming into countries.
Right. And
I
was, no one is blaming them. If I was, you know, in
Mexico or
Hong Kong, I would be doing the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not blaming people in Mexico for trying to get here. What I'm suggesting is that what we're seeing is a failure of leadership in Mexico. And frankly, I think the failure of the leadership, and I've worked in South America considerably, in Colombia and in Peru and in Ecuador, is frankly traceable back to the Catholic Church's birth control policies. You just have this absolute explosion of population and the oppression of women that is institutionalized. And we know that when women have equal rights with men, population stabilizes. And as long as women are oppressed, population explodes. And so there's this huge population explosion, which drives down average wealth. I mean, it's just after the Great Plague in London in 1344 or whenever it was, right after that was, you know, this explosion of economic activity because there were fewer people for the same amount of resources. And that's what you're looking at. Here we have fewer
people.
Mira,
gracias, muchacho, por la oportunidad.
Okay. Thanks, Tomas. Yeah. It's, you know, I think this is a real challenge. And our work should not be, I mean, you know, yes, we need to enforce our borders, but we also need to be working with South America and saying, you know, and Central America, how can we help solve the problem? Thanks.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told. If you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. 20% of Iraq veterans who are in at least 5 firefights are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, according to a new study by the New England Journal of Medicine. PTSD is debilitating, causing headaches, sleeplessness, hypervigilance, and depression. The disorder has plagued a total of 12.6% of soldiers returning from Iraq, and the chances of suffering from it only increases with the amount of time spent in combat zones.
In the foreword to Tom Hartman's book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, renowned author Joseph Chilton Pierce writes,
"To discover brilliant, innovative, creative, and original thinking is one of life's rare privileges. To discover that such a thinker has focused on the most critical of all issues facing our species is encouraging. Because The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight is a seminal work, offering a viewpoint original yet ancient, I see our situation today in a new light. And because of the scope and depth of this work, I find it inspiring as well as disturbing. I rather exhausted superlative in praise of Tom Hartman's book, The Prophet's Way, which I rightly called the most important book I've ever read. But now I find this sequel calling for equal praise, since the issue here addresses the whole of our species, and indeed all species."
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman, in bookstores everywhere.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I was one of you who stood up for you.
And welcome back, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. You know what it gets down to, really, the bottom line here is, what are the rules of the game? What are the boundaries? What are you allowed to do and what are you not allowed to do in the game of business and of work? And there's really, you know, kind of two sides of this. If you want to play the game of business and you want to make money, how do you have to treat that one dimension of your, well, actually, several. How do you have to treat the environment? How do you have to treat, however, that one human dimension of your business, the people who work for you? Do we as a society have the right? Do we collectively, we the people, the holders of the rights in the United States, do we have the right to say that we are going to use the power of government, which reflects the power of we the people? It's the controlled power of we the people. Do we have the right to use the power of government to say to ourselves, here's the rules. You want to run a business? You can't belch mercury into the air. You can't hire 10-year-olds and keep them out of school. If somebody works for you, you must pay them at least, here in the state of Vermont, $7 an hour, nationally $5.15 an hour, as I recall. Do we have the right to say, okay, in order to have a decent income in the United States, it takes at least $7 an hour. In some parts of the country, it takes $8, $9, $10, $12 an hour. I mean, you know, try living in Manhattan or Los Angeles, where rents are, you know, just for big cities all over the country, very, very high. And so, how about us getting together and saying, you know, we're going to set up a set of rules here so that everybody who actually works at this thing, anybody who says, I'm in the game, I'm going to give it everything I have, I'm going to put all my effort into it, that they're going to share in the rewards of the game, at least to the level of survival in what we might call middle-class comfort. Right? Survive, the ability, as Teddy Roosevelt said, a living wage, the ability to raise your children, to pay for their education or make sure that they're educated all the way through, to pay for health care, and to have something left over for retirement. It just seems rational to me. Of course, the cons would say, no, no, we need an ownership society where those who own, own, and those who don't, don't. 1-866-889-8894. Kate in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Kate, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to get back to Jefferson for just a minute.
Sure.
Because of the quotes that you've been reading on the radio, I was inspired and I was able to spend 2 full days in Monticello just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, my goodness. I've never been there.
Oh, my God.
I really want to go.
You have to go. It's a first priority.
Yeah.
And also the University of Virginia. So inspiring. And my question is, based on the research that you've done, I think that I wanted to ask you what your opinion was, because I think Jefferson's been marginalized because he didn't free his slaves.
Yeah.
And the question was there the whole time on the tours that I took. I took several house tours, and, you know, people were just kind of, you know, dumbfounded. Why didn't he free his slaves? So what was your research? There must have been a compelling reason.
Yeah, when he introduced this law into the House of Burgesses, they reacted. They punished him by passing a law which said that if you freed your slaves in the state of Virginia, you had to take them to the border of one of the other states and put them into that state. And if they got caught there, tough luck. And if they happened to get caught under any circumstances in the state of Virginia, at any time, in any way, even if they were freed in another state, they could be arrested and immediately sold at auction. And which made it virtually impossible for anybody in Virginia who wasn't extremely wealthy to free their slaves. And Washington, George Washington, on his deathbed, couldn't afford to free all his slaves. Jefferson could only afford to free half a dozen, you know, basically the Hemings family.
Right.
It became this huge economic burden. And then they passed another law I'll tell you about right after this break. Thanks
Great.
For the
we
call,
Kate. We need to know more about that.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 29 minutes past the hour. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
According to an internal memo, government workers at the nation's airports are constantly subjected to abuse and extreme stress. The memo, written by Marcia Florian, the federal security director in Phoenix, Arizona, and obtained by the Seattle Times, says screeners have endured false promises from hiring contractors, weeks or months with no pay or benefits, mandatory conversion to part-time, forced overtime, and now a recertification process that shows no regard for screener morale, effectiveness, or livelihood. The Times interviewed more than 100 current or former Transportation Security Administration employees who verified multiple abuses. The Department of Homeland Security placed Florian on administrative leave Tuesday morning.
The International Professional and Technical Engineers have members concentrated in the swing states of Pennsylvania and Washington. IFPTE Legislative Political Director Matt Biggs has seen firsthand how the Bush administration's policies hurt labor.
With respect to the Department of Homeland Security, when he created that, he aimed to gut union rights, and he did that, as well as civil service protections that federal employees historically enjoy. And his latest maneuver is through the Department of Defense, which employs 720,000 federal civil servants nationwide. The President and Secretary Rumsfeld are aiming to completely gut the collective bargaining, the pay structures, the veterans' preference, and EEOC protections, among other things, of the 720,000 federal civil servants employed by DOD. So it was pretty much a no-brainer. Senator Kerry's record on all of these issues, by the way, is stellar.
The clock is ticking as the World Trade Organization tries to hammer out the framework for trade talks by the end of the week. Last year's WTO conference in Cancun, Mexico, imploded amid deep rifts between rich and poor countries. The discussions, currently being held in Geneva, are an attempt to mend those rifts. However, the organization is already walking a thin line, as African nations have expressed they will not sign anything unless their concerns about subsidies paid to cotton farmers in rich countries, namely the United States, are addressed. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Depending on whose statistics you choose, the unemployment rate in Iraq runs between 28 and 50%. For a proper perspective on this catastrophe, the unemployment rate in the United States during the Great Depression peaked at 25%, and the situation is getting worse. Iraqi construction firms have been cut out of all but the smallest rebuilding projects, and American contractors are importing cheap labor from Pakistan and India instead of giving the work to Iraqis who desperately need it.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service.
For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the beat goes on. The beat goes on.
Yeah, and the beat of slavery goes on as well.
Drums keep pounding.
Let me just address this really quickly, what Kate raised, because this is a really significant issue, and it's one that I think we as Americans today need to be looking back on and looking today at. The second law, Kate, that was passed by the good fathers of Virginia to punish Jefferson by and large. I mean, it was a reactive sort of thing for his proposing the end of slavery in Virginia was a law that said, and I quote, each woman servant got with child by her master shall after her time by indenture or custom as expired be by the churchwarden of the parish where she lived when she was brought to bed of such bastard sold for 2 years. Now, to convert that into modern English, what it means is that, keep in mind, Sally Hemings was the half-sister of Jefferson's wife. In fact, many people who visited remarked on how much she looked like his wife. They shared a father and a grandfather. And when Jefferson was in Paris after his wife died, he was the U.S. envoy to Paris, and Sally Hemings, when she was in her teenage years, came over along with her brother, two of her brothers, and in France she was free. She could have walked away. In fact, it was one of the challenges for slaveholders who went to Europe was because as the minute their slaves stepped foot on European soil, the slaveholders had no control over them. They had no legal right to hold them. And in fact, you know, the French, and in some cases the British, but the French were very into it, would go out of their way to help liberate the slaves. Right. So anyhow, Sally and I forget the name of the two brothers that went with her. I think it was Eustace and Thomas. But in any case, was over there. And by the time they came back and settled back into Monticello, it was sort of an open secret that there was something going on with this young woman who was the half-sister of Jefferson's dead wife. And this law was passed that said if a baby was produced between a master and a slave, then the slave and the children would be given to a local church warden for a period of 2 years for, quote, hard Christian labor, end quote, and then would be sold into the general slave market. And that, you know, certainly, I think, changed Jefferson's mind about being out about it at all. Although, you know, it was not a secret in the day. In fact, the newspapers wrote about it. I think it's really easy for us in this day and age to look back 200 years and criticize Jefferson for all this. I mean, it's just, you know, he used cheap labor. This was the resource of his slaves to maintain his lifestyle. You can't say it any other way. And the consequence of his failure to abolish slavery was a bloody civil war followed by 100 years of legal apartheid. And he foresaw that. He was wretched about it. And yet he used the cheap labor of slaves. He rationalized it by keeping them in a style that was better than that of a lot of poor whites of the day, but both were grim by today's standards. But that was just a rationalization. His lifestyle, here's the bottom line, his lifestyle was made possible by slave labor, and there's no other way to say it. Recognizing that, many Americans, you know, a lot of us say, well, you know, get righteously indignant, quick to judge him. Here's my question. How many of us are willing to free our slaves? Are you willing to free your slaves? You say, what? I don't have any slaves. The mixer board that is sitting in front of me, made by Mackie, is made in China. The computer on my desk, an IBM, is made in parts of it are made in Malaysia. The shirt I'm wearing was made by slaves, because there are no, shirts are not made in the United States anymore. The lamp that's lighting this room was manufactured in China. Levi Strauss just closed their last American jeans factory this year. Odds are the pants I'm wearing were made by slaves. I can rationalize all the products of these distant slaves that I use. After all, I don't have to look into their faces like Jefferson did, which may account for why Jefferson's biographer, Fawn Brody, talks about how whenever he went on a trip, when he came back, he always brought gifts for his slaves. And his household ledgers show evidence that he smuggled significant sums of money to sums of cash to Sally Hemings over the years. But it's still, just like Jefferson, a rationalization. The stark reality is that we in America did not end slavery. We merely exported it. And it's so much more comfortable for us to criticize Jefferson for agonizing over, but still using, slave labor 200 years ago, when we don't have to look into the faces of today's slaves who are toiling and dying at this very moment to sustain our lifestyles. And that, you know, end of rant. That's the bottom line for me. And that's where you get into the bigger picture, right? You know, the how we stand in the world. Oh, let's just have a free trade agreement. So anybody in some other country who has some slaves, whether it's slave labor like in China, prison labor, or whether the entire nation is a prison like Malaysia, or whether it's just the slavery of grinding, oppressive poverty, the consequence of decisions made by church and state. You know, well, it's just free trade. It doesn't matter. No, it does. It does. And that's why, you know, I am very hopeful that we will find in the White House next year, and in Congress, and in the United States Senate, men and women of conscience and insight and understanding, people who truly have some sense of what's going on. Because, keep in mind, it was the Supreme Court in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896 that defined separate but equal. It was the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 that reversed that. It was the Supreme Court that in 1973, in Roe v. Wade, reversed its 1873 case of Bradwell versus State, where Sarah Bradwell walked into a courtroom after getting her law degree in Chicago, Illinois, walked into a courtroom in Chicago, and the judge looked down and said, "You're a woman, you have to leave." He threw her out of his courtroom because he would not allow a woman to practice law in his courtroom. She sued him. She actually sued the state of Illinois because he was simply enforcing laws that were on the books. Bradwell versus State, 1873. She sued him. It went to the United States Supreme Court, and she lost. The United States Supreme Court ruled that women did not have access to the Bill of Rights. And in 1973, 100 years later, a different Supreme Court said, well, you know, women do have access to the Bill of Rights, and they do have a Fourth Amendment right of privacy. Because Roe v. Wade was really not about abortion. It was about whether or not women have access to the Constitution equal with men. And whoever is in the White House 1 year from today is going to appoint enough justices to the Supreme Court to define the way our Constitution and laws are interpreted for the next generation or two. That is the most critical outcome of this election, in my opinion. As Al Sharpton shared with us.
With the prospect of, in the next 4 years, that two or more Supreme Court justices' seats will become available. This year, we celebrated the anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. This court has voted 5-4 on critical issues of women's rights and civil rights. It is frightening to think that the gains of civil and women's rights and those movements in the last century could be reversed if this administration is in the White House in these next 4 years. I suggest to you tonight that if George Bush had selected the court in 54, Clarence Thomas would have never got to law school.
And that is so true, because Clarence Thomas and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell all got into college, and this is no slam on them. This is the way it is in America. They all got into college because of affirmative action programs, those same programs that the Republicans now seek to do away with. And yes, I think it would be wonderful if there was if we were at a point in American history where we could say we really don't need this anymore. We can demonstrate that African Americans and whites have relative equality economically and educationally. We don't need to intervene in that, in the remnants of, you know, the echoes of the marketplace of slavery any longer. But that's not the reality. That's not the reality. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Taxi driver number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico on the line. Hey, number 12, how you doing?
You know, the other day I went out to the store and I bought three things, and I do this all the time. I always look what they're made. And two of them were made in China. And one was actually, thank goodness, made in Taiwan. And I have actually written emails to lawmakers saying, you know, you need to do something because this is not cool. I would rather pay more money, you know, for it to be made by an American or someplace other than, you know, a totalitarian dictatorship.
Yeah, well,
it is slavery. I mean, like, I was reading in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago about how, you know, American cars are outsourcing all these parts, and they're not even telling, you know, the American consumer, that your Ford, your Chevy is being made in China, and the disparity in the wages that they pay. I mean, I know our money is more powerful, but you know, American auto worker makes $22 an hour, and the Chinese parts manufacturer makes 90 cents an hour, and I'm sure they don't have any benefits and.
Yeah. If that, I mean, you know,
and common stuff like that. I think really, if you brought it all back home, you would find that it would just pump up our economy even more, because not in addition to the fact that we're not supporting, you know, one of the worst governments on planet Earth, you're going to give a lot more Americans good jobs, which is going to create more domestic cash flow.
Amen, brother. I mean, here's the key. If we were to bring it all back home, you would have the economy that we had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Sure.
You would have the middle class back again.
I'm a liberal kind of guy, but I think it's a great idea. I mean, buy American all the way.
Yeah, and see, the problem is that what we're saying, and see, this isn't about evil business people. The problem is the rules of the game. We're saying to people who are in business, hey, the rules of the game are that you can either make it in the United States and pay $22 an hour, you can make it in China and pay 90 cents an hour, and you get to choose. But you're responsible to your stockholders, and if you don't show a profit, they have the right to fire you. Now, what are you going to do? And so, you know, what we need to do is we need to go back to the way the game was played before 1980, before Ronald Reagan got in and stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and started dismantling many of our international trade agreements. Then George Bush gets in and starts pushing fast-track authority so that the president himself can grease the skids of the industries that help get him into the White House. And then Bill Clinton demands that and gets it, and then he pushes through GATT and NAFTA. I mean, this is not Democrat-Republican. This is conservative economic policies that are dismantling the middle class in the United States. And Clinton is as guilty of it as any of these other guys.
Another thing that really bothers me is the fact that we're giving all this money and all this technology to China, and they're pointing missiles at us.
Well, and not only that, we can't build a missile in the United States right now without chips from China.
No, and consider that for a minute. And another thing that really bothers me is the fact that, last fall, that the Chinese shot an astronaut in the space. What that said to me was, honestly, I don't like Clinton. What he did is, I believe he gave the Chinese a working nuclear missile arsenal piecemeal. And with the moonshot or the space shot of the Chinese astronaut going up, it was just an announcement to the world that they have ICBM technology.
Sure, sure. I was amazed when that happened that it wasn't a Sputnik moment. I mean, I remember when Sputnik went up. It was, 56, was it? I was like 5 years old, 6 years old, and there was this thing going over the, you know, in the sky, and it was going bing, 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 bing. That's all it did. It just transmitted a little bing. And America was freaked out. You know, Eisenhower was president, and the reason that I remember it so well, number one, I remember how cool I thought it was, you know, that there's something up there pinging. But also, they started educational programs in the United States. We started, as a result of Sputnik going up, we just threw piles of money. The Eisenhower administration threw piles of money into our public education system and said, we've got to raise a generation of scientists. And I was the beneficiary of some of that in public school. I was in one of those accelerated programs, and those programs all died in the first years of the Nixon administration because he had to pay for the war in Vietnam.
And one thing, this isn't slightly off the subject, but 10 years ago, let's say 10, 12 years ago, the Chinese couldn't get a rocket into the next province, much less another country. Yeah. Now they can launch into space and have it come back down anywhere they want to. I don't think that's basically something we should be supporting economically.
Yeah, I agree. Number 12, I thought you were a conservative. What happened? You've been listening to the show too long?
No, I've always thought that. I mean, there's other things that you would vehemently disagree with me, but basically I do not think you should give, it's not based on conservative, it's because the Amish are conservative, but they are also pretty socially liberal. Catholic Church is very conservative, but they are also very socially liberal. They have all sorts of soup kitchens and charities and things.
But you're talking about restraining trade. Because the way to do this is to put up tariffs, is to go back to saying we are going to have bilateral trade agreements, we're going to negotiate trade agreements with countries, and we're going to have tariffs that say, okay, if you want to make auto parts in China, that's fine, and you can make them for 90 cents over there, but we're going to charge you $21.10 per hour of labor when you import them back into the United States.
It comes, fertilize your own garden, and you're going to get the indigenous results.
There you go. Amen. Number 12, thanks for the call. Good point. I appreciate it. 10 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, helping you win the water cooler wars. Stick around.
Tom Hartman will be speaking out in Santa Fe, New Mexico with We the People, a call to take back America, a Friday evening talk August 27th at the Santa Fe Armory for the Arts, to be followed by a Saturday, August 28th workshop called Waking Up to Personal and Global Transformation. Tom Hartman brings his wit, wisdom, and intelligence to Santa Fe the weekend of August 27th and 28th. Tom Hartman will discuss with us how America faces its greatest threat since a civil war, and Tom Hartman will look at how Western thinking, legends, and myths have caused global problems and endangered democracy and what we can do about it. To get your tickets and more information, call 505-988-2223 in Santa Fe. That's 505-988-2223 or visit greatmystery.org. Tickets for Tom Hartman are also available at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world.
world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
A leading environmentalist says a growing gap between haves and have-nots is at the root of international terrorism. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Resentment is on the rise around the world, according to Paul Ehrlich, and it's directed at the world's wealthiest societies. Ehrlich and his wife Anne have written a new book called One with Nineveh. It argues that the growing gap between rich and poor countries is driving terrorism.
9/11 should have been more than catastrophic enough to open our eyes to dealing with the roots of terrorism. After all, we live in a world where something like 3 billion people live on $2 a day or less, while the average European cow is subsidized to a tune of $2.50 a day.
Ehrlich says he's not justifying acts of terrorism, but he says we should figure out what drives it. Most of the people drawn to terrorist groups come from desperately poor communities in places like Pakistan.
The basic root of terrorism, of course, is that many, many people are getting educated in poor countries but have no prospects for decent livings, and there are even more people who are not educated who basically just feel desperate and see the vast wealth of the rich countries, and that tends to enrage them.
Ehrlich says it's in our own interest to help fight poverty and disease in developing countries.
The gap between the rich and the poor, which is growing in the United States and between nations in many cases, is something we all should be concerned about, because remember, not only are the poor more susceptible to diseases that can move to us, but of course they also are now armed with nuclear weapons, with biological weapons, with chemical weapons, and so they are able to make lots of trouble for us, even if we thought it were ethical for us to continue to live high on the hog while they starve.
That's Paul Ehrlich, author of the new book, One with Nineveh. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Blessed are the one-way ticket holders on the one-way street. Blessed are the midnight riders, for in the shadow of God they sleep.
Amen. Welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talking about the state of the world, the state of the Democratic National Convention, the DNC of the DNC going on in Boston. You know, frankly, I've got to say, the strategy that the Democrats are employing is move to the center. Right? Let's have this thing nicely scripted, carefully scripted, move to the center. There have been, in the 20th century, there were two landslide elections won by Democrats, and only two. Well, actually, only two candidates. One of them won two landslides. And those two were Lyndon Johnson, when he was explicitly campaigning on carrying forward the idea of civil rights and the great society. And Franklin Roosevelt, when he was campaigning on creating Social Security and the WPA and all that sort of stuff. And every other time, I mean, Jack Kennedy tried to play in the middle. He said he was going to out Nixon. You know, he's going to be more of a warrior. He won by only 100,000 votes. I mean, every other time, Democrat and Clinton did okay, but I don't think it had anything to do with his policies. I think it had to do with the fact that he's a brilliant politician. What are your thoughts? Jonathan in Palm Desert, 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hey, that's a good point. But there's something I wanted to mention. With number 12 calling earlier,
yeah,
mentioning that Clinton had given away our nuclear secrets to China.
Yeah, you know, there was that whole Republican attack machine thing on him about that.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that mostly the fault of a Katrina Leung, who was a Chinese counterintelligence agent?
Yeah, who was sleeping with the FBI agents who were making the chart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, and was going out, basically having an affair with a James J. Smith, who was her handler, and a William Cleveland Jr., who was both in the Chinese counterintelligence and then worked for the Lawrence Livermore Lab.
Yeah, and beyond, and beyond that, I don't think...
1980s.
Yeah, and yeah, from the 80s, yeah. This went back to the Reagan and the Bush administrations, number one. And number two, you know, the Chinese, I don't think that they need to spy all that much. All they need to do is say, hey, we'll make chips for one of the American defense contractors. I mean,
exactly.
That's the tragic and unfortunate reality is that we're just giving this stuff away, our technologies. We can't make a shirt in the United States anymore. We can hardly make steel. And it's bad for our nation. I mean, it's terrible for the middle class, but it's also bad. Bad policy. It's bad national policy. Jonathan,
well,
thanks
I'm
for
doing my best to try to buy American these days. Thanks to No Sweatshop Apparel, it's getting a little better.
Yeah, SweatX and No Sweatshop Apparel, great ideas and great products. But
you
we need to change.
Well.
Yeah, we need to change the rules of the game. Jonathan, thanks for the call.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
According to an internal memo, government workers at the nation's airports are constantly subjected to abuse and extreme stress. The memo, written by Marcia Florian, the federal security director in Phoenix, Arizona, and obtained by the Seattle Times, says screeners have endured false promises from hiring contractors, weeks or months with no pay or benefits, mandatory conversion to part-time, forced overtime, and now a recertification process that shows no regard for screener morale, effectiveness, or livelihood. The Times interviewed more than 100 current or former Transportation Security Administration employees who verified multiple abuses. The Department of Homeland Security placed Florian on administrative leave Tuesday morning.
The International Professional and Technical Engineers have members concentrated in the swing states of Pennsylvania and Washington. IFPTE Legislative Political Director Matt...
Federal civil servants employed by DOD. So it was pretty much a no-brainer. Senator Kerry's record on all of these issues, by the way, is stellar.
The clock is ticking as the World Trade Organization tries to hammer out the framework for trade talks by the end of the week. Last year's WTO conference in Cancun, Mexico imploded amid deep rifts between rich and poor countries. The discussions, currently being held in Geneva, are an attempt to mend those rifts. However, the organization is already walking a thin line, as African nations have expressed they will not sign anything unless their concerns about subsidies paid to cotton farmers in rich countries, namely the United States, are addressed. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Depending on whose statistics you choose, the unemployment rate in Iraq runs between 28 and 50%. For a proper perspective on this catastrophe, the unemployment rate in the United States during the Great Depression peaked at 25%, and the situation is getting worse. Iraqi construction firms have been cut out of all but the smallest rebuilding projects, and American contractors are importing cheap labor from Pakistan and India instead of giving the work to Iraqis who desperately need it.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send your job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in a recovery. Then after a year, you finally land another job, and you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
Despicable is not a word that major corporate executives are used to having untested and uncertified software in its machines, then lied about it. Their performance, their behavior is despicable, Shelley bluntly said. He also put action behind his words, banning the use of more than 14,000 Diebold machines for this November's election, saying that the machines are not secure and reliable. He also recommended that criminal charges be filed for what he called fraudulent actions by Diebold. Shelley had earlier ruled that by 2006, touchscreen voting machines in California must produce a paper receipt so voters can verify the electoral choices they make on these corruptible computers. But after this year's unpleasantness with Diebold, Shelley says he's now exploring ways to speed up this requirement. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, in Maryland, a voters group has filed suit to block the use of all 16,000 of Diebold's virtual voting machines in their state unless a paper verification system is installed on each of them. It's all a part of the growing grassroots rebellion to prevent the electronic theft of our elections. To join the fight, go to www.verifiedvoting.org.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told. If you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
When Gore came out of the last convention, they had only $4 million until the federal money kicked in. Now, of course, they have a lot more money with this money kicking in to get them through till September, till the Republicans end their convention, until the federal money kicks in.
Right.
In addition to the fact that there have been nine polls coming into the convention. If you average them all together, there is a two-point average advantage, essentially, for Kerry.
You mean a bounce?
Well, no. Before they even came to the convention, before the bounce. And apparently there has only been one other president that led with the 2 points that has essentially turned it into the presidency, and that was Reagan, coming into the convention in that kind of way. They also said it's the smallest undecided ever, and they are trying to really work on that younger under 34, under 35 crowd demographic.
The thing that amazes me is the smallest undecided ever. People just are not thinking. It has been 1,060 days since 9/11. Between the time that we were hit with Pearl Harbor and we invaded Normandy was roughly the same amount of time. It was maybe 2 months different. And look at what we did between the time of Pearl Harbor and the time of the Normandy invasion. I mean, we launched this full blow, and yet Bush is still sitting around going, well, I guess maybe we'll start to protect the homeland someday.
Well, that is the issue. I talked to several members of Congress late last night, actually. And, again, most of them were very upset in retrospect that they felt lied to. And they did tell this to me off the record as well as on the record. And they all also said that we got ourselves in a mess that it's going to be very hard to get out of, not just in Iraq, but in terms of Afghanistan, because of the situation there. And so, actually, that is part of the foreign policy team that that Kerry is working with. And I think that I will not be surprised if the Afghanistan issue and the Kerry campaign does not hit hard on that as well as Iraq, both in the debates and in the next 3 months.
Yeah. Ellen Ratner, would you think that this policy, this very conscious decision to play to the middle, that Terry McAuliffe and company and presumably John Kerry have signed off on and are going for, is, you know, how is it being received? It seems, you know, just looking back, it seems that the two big landslide Democratic victories in the 20th century were FDR when in his second and third term, when he became a liberal and pushed through things like Social Security, and Lyndon Johnson when he was promoting the Great Society and civil rights. And every time Democrats have tried to play it down the middle, they've gotten, you know, they've just barely slid by. Jack Kennedy, you know, almost.
And Bill Clinton did. But I think what happened is they are going to put, they're going to put Sharpton out to keep the base going.
Yeah. First hour of our program, we had Charlie Matulka on, who went up against Chuck Hagel when Chuck Hagel was the president of the voting machine company. He was president of ES&S, or the head of ES&S.
Right.
And then decided to run for the Senate. But anyway,
he knew how the machines worked.
Well, he sold them to the state. This was the state of Nebraska.
Right.
I don't want to rehash that hour. But
right.
What do you think what was the response among the insiders there to Al Sharpton running over last night?
You know what? Everybody loved it.
I figured.
Honestly, I mean, he was just giving meat. You know, just like Bush is going to talk about family values and just feed the base the little meat that they want, and they'll put up Gary Bauer or some evil person like that. And then the Democrats will put up Sharpton to feed the base, and that's what they're doing. Because, you know, a lot of people, you have a lot of machinists who are here. You have a lot of teachers who are here, NEA, a lot of those kinds of delegates because of the Democratic Party rules, which are very different for, you know, they have to have a much more sort of rainbow kind of base here.
Mm-hmm. So, which raises the question then, I think, inevitably, where are the Democrats at? I mean, they've got this platform that's milquetoast. They've got a candidate, Kerry.
The worst I've ever seen.
Yeah, they've got a candidate, Kerry.
The 48 platform had more in it.
Oh, yeah. Well, the 48 platform had national health care in it.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, you know, Harry Truman wanted a single-payer health care system, the same as the military had for the rest of the country. And it went down in defeat. But you've got this milquetoast thing, and Kerry, I mean, I think a lot of people feel that even though there's all these position papers on his website, he hasn't really been talking issues that much. Edwards kind of danced around a couple of issues last night, but not a whole lot. And I think a lot of Democrats or a lot of liberals or a lot of progressives, a lot of people on the left, a lot of people in the middle are saying, you know, what are these people really about? I mean, is this going to backfire on them trying to be all things to all people?
Look, no more than it is going to be with the Republican. The fact is the ABB crowd is long and strong here, and it is uniting the Democrats. And you know, honestly, I don't think it's just my convention bounce. I actually think Kerry has a chance of pulling this off.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I this is what I'm hearing from America, too, is...
I will be talking to you tomorrow on my post-convention.
Great. Ellen, thank you for calling. I truly appreciate it. It's wonderful to hear from you. And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
You got it.
Okay. Keep on keeping on. It's the Tom Hartman Program's 14 minutes past the hour. Speaking of the convention, let's go back here and hear this little note from Al Sharpton, his talk last night. It was absolutely a brilliant speech. And, you know, it so troubles me how people like Tucker Carlson trivialize people. You know, he's I'm the Al Sharpton guy. You know, it's patronizing and sad, frankly. But whom, whether or not they, you know, or who is smoking what, and progressive, liberal, I'd say traditional American morality. includes those issues, of course. Of course. We don't want our children to be promiscuous. We don't want, of course. And includes the idea that we're all in this thing together. The radical idea that you find, you know, if you look to the religious literature, you find in Judaism and the idea of tikkun, that if you're born into the world, you have an obligation to heal the world. Jesus said in Matthew 25, you know, as you do to the least of these, my brother, you do unto me, you know, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit those in prison, care for the sick. Just very straightforward stuff. What kind of world do we want to live in? Do you want to live in the kind of world, in the kind of nation, where when you walk out your front door, you're confronted with begging children with runny noses and sores all over them? I have lived and worked in countries where that's the reality. You literally walk out the door and there's 20 kids there with their hands out and they follow you down the street. Is that the kind of world, is that the kind of nation that we want? Because that's going to be the end result of conservative economic policies. The war on the middle class that Ronald Reagan declared in the 1980s when the earning power of Americans began to decline and the middle class began to slide. And there was this the beginning of this great shift in wealth away from the American middle class and towards a very, very small elite at the very top who loved to say, oh, when anybody mentions this, it's class warfare. As Warren Buffett said, the second richest man in America, said, there is indeed class warfare in America, and my class is winning. Warren Buffett, quote unquote. And it gets down to close enough to farms that there was that bounce, as it were. There was this tremendous agricultural middle class, and it got wiped out by the industrialization of the United States. I'm not saying that was a bad thing, it's just what happened. And so in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, Roosevelt said, well, you know, if we're going to have a middle class, which is important to democracy, we're going to have to create it in an industrial society, which has never been done before. Never been done before. Read Dickens. England, industrial England in the 1700s, early 1800s. There was no middle class. You were rich or you were poor. You were Bob Cratchit or you were Ebenezer Scrooge. There was nothing in between. Or very, very little. The middle class was much, much smaller than the class of the working poor. Because conservative economic policies always bring about a situation where you've got a lot of desperately poor people who work very, very hard and can barely get by, and you've got a few very rich people. And Roosevelt and Americans in the 1930s said, we would like to have a middle class. So in 1935, we passed the Wagner Act, which made unionization legal and possible, which was then has been largely rolled back by conservatives since then. We passed Social Security, which has not been keeping up with the cost of living since then. We passed a minimum wage, which has not been keeping up with the cost of living. And guess what? Our middle class is evaporating. What a surprise. 20 minutes after the hour, Tom Hartman here.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told. if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has
been in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Lie down, people. Lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go.
Welcome back.
The opium crop was blown away. Let them poppies grow.
Afghanistan just brought in the largest opium crop in history.
It's back today. Only goes to show.
Anyhow, 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Have you seen this thing on the web? It's sort of like eBay, only instead of buying things, you win them. Prizewise.com. Strangest thing. It'd be interesting to see where that goes. 1-866-889-8894. Roberta in northern New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roberta, what's up?
Yes, Tom. Good ojo caliente, at least for now. A couple of points. I really admire your stand calling yourself a populist nationalist. That seems very accurate. And I would suggest that the day you realize that dichotomy, you will become a democratic socialist. I would say that Thomas Jefferson was that. I think that his slave issue
that he was
which? Untenable for him.
That he was
so,
which?
Because
he,
I think hey,
Roberta,
he treated his
Roberta, can you hear me?
Slaves as a commune.
Apparently not. Roberta?
Yes?
You said, I think Thomas Jefferson was that. Was he a, did you mean he was a nationalist or he was a socialist?
Oh, I think that he was a socialist, of course,
okay.
Because his slaves were treated well. And I think under the circumstances and the environment of the times, he probably treated them as a cooperative. He gave them money. He gave them a good life. He couldn't free them. He couldn't marry Sally Hemings without being arrested. And I think that that he was a kind of socialist, the same, and espouse his views in.
Well, I don't own slaves. I just use the products of slavery, as all of us do in this country, which is, in my opinion, a crime, and I think that we need to do something about it. But
Tom, could I take this opportunity to say something else I've been wanting to say for quite some time?
Certainly.
because when you spoke for me so well and graciously honored me for my civil disobedience, which I never really thanked you for publicly, I would like to do so. But I would like to say that I am not a pacifist. I was always a misfit or a maverick wherever I went in social activism. I do believe in the Second Amendment, and I agree with cabbie number 12. And I do believe in the right to self-defense. I think when one declares war with the state, the nonviolent protocol of Gandhi is the best and only way that really works, the only moral and civil way to do it.
Well, it's also the only way that produces the outcome you want.
And Gandhi himself, I was surprised when I studied him, was also for the principle of self-defense on a personal basis. I was surprised to see that. But he said, nonviolence is never an excuse for cowardice. It takes the bravest soul. And whenever I talk about my experiences as in jail...
Focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
According to an internal memo, government workers at the nation's airports are constantly subjected to abuse and extreme stress. The memo, written by Marcia Florian, the federal security director in Phoenix, Arizona, and obtained by the Seattle Times, says screeners have endured false promises from hiring contractors, weeks or months with no pay or benefits, mandatory conversion department
rights, and he did that, as well as civil service protections that federal employees historically enjoy. And his latest maneuver is through the Department of Defense, which employs 720,000 federal civil servants nationwide. The President and Secretary Rumsfeld are aiming to completely gut the collective bargaining, the pay structures, the veterans' preference, and EEOC protections, among other things, of the 720,000 federal civil servants employed by DOD. So it was pretty much a no-brainer. Senator Kerry's record on all of these issues, by the way, is stellar.
The clock is ticking as the World Trade Organization tries to hammer out the framework for trade talks by the end of the week. Last year's WTO conference in Cancun, Mexico imploded amid deep rifts between rich and poor countries. The discussions, currently being held in Geneva, are an attempt to mend those rifts. However, the organization is already walking a thin line, as African nations have expressed they will not sign anything unless their concerns about subsidies paid to cotton farmers in rich countries, namely the United States, are addressed. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Depending on whose statistics you choose, the unemployment rate in Iraq runs between 28 and 50%. For a proper perspective on this catastrophe, the unemployment rate in the United States during the Great Depression peaked at 25%, and the situation is getting worse. Iraqi construction firms have been cut out of all but the smallest rebuilding projects, and American contractors are importing cheap labor from Pakistan and India instead of giving the work to Iraqis who desperately need it.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Taking a while here. Where is this going? Welcome back. The White House will project soon that this year's federal deficit. This is the little secret that the White House has that they don't want you to know about. I mean, they've got a spin all in place for it. They have the spin in place. The spin that is in place is that about 6 months ago, the White House said
The federal deficit is going to be $521 billion. See, Karl Rove has figured out the importance of playing to or against expectation. For example, with the Democratic National Convention and with John Kerry choosing John, this little narrow 10, 15, maybe 20%, depending on whose poll numbers you're looking at, but probably right around 12, 13, 14, 15%. The very tiny thing. Very tiny number of people. So, you know, if it's normally 30, 40%, and you have a convention and you nominate your running mate, and you get all that publicity and it's on TV, and of course it used to be that the TV networks, I mean, when I was a kid, the TV networks ran the conventions like all day. Well, to some extent, they had to. They were required to run a certain amount of politics. They ran the debates. You know, preempted prime time and everything. The government said, hey, you want to make money on our public airwaves? You have to give back. That all went away after 1978. Boston versus Bilotti Supreme Court decision. But that's another rant. Anyhow, the White House, Karl Rove knew that the most bounce that anybody could get out of picking a running mate and having a convention would be 4 or 5 points, because there's only about 10-12% of the people who are undecided right now. We've got people who are so polarized in America by George Bush, this extraordinary divisive man, and then you got like Newt Gingrich last week meeting with Republicans saying, point to the wedge issues. Stay with the wedge issues. What do you know? Wedges drive people. Wedge splits things, right? So they knew that it wasn't possible. It wasn't possible for Kerry to get more than 2 or 3 points of bounce out of either naming Edwards as his running mate or the convention. So what did they do? They deployed an army of people, led by former Enron lobbyist, $700,000 a year Enron lobbyist, until he was fired by Enron, Ed Gillespie. He used to work for Kenny Boy Lay, the number one lifetime campaign contributor to George W. Bush. And, of course, he was then former Enron lobbyist Ed Gillespie was hired to run the Republican National Committee, one of many former Enron lobbyists working for the Republicans now. And, you know, they did all these talk shows and they said, we're expecting that Kerry's going to get a 15-point bounce, 13, 16. I mean, they were all in the teens, right? But we're thinking it's going to be around a 15-point bounce when they knew it was impossible. There's not 15 points to bounce. It's just impossible. And so then Kerry names Edwards as his running mate and he gets a 2 or 3 point bounce, which was quite respectable. But then the cons get to say, he's not doing well, is he? Look at that. Because everybody's saying, oh, he's going to get a 15-point bounce. Wow, he's going to go from 50% in the polls up to 65% in the polls. I don't think so. But that was the expectation that they defined. Isn't it amazing how these guys try to manipulate us? I mean, it's just, you know, part of me is in awe of it, and part of me is horrified and disgusted by it. So anyhow, they last 6-8 months ago, the White House, about the same time that the Congressional Budget Office, which is this nonpartisan or bipartisan, but no, it's nonpartisan. These are bureaucrats who work for Congress. They have no party affiliation. They don't work for the two parties. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, in January of this year. Seven months ago, coming up on 8 months ago, said that the deficit this year will be $477 billion. That's what they projected. Last year's deficit was $375 billion. So what does the White House do? They come out and they say, well, we think the deficit is going to be $521 billion. They provided no backup, no documentation, no breakdown. They simply said $521 billion. And it's been bantied about in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and everything. And they got their bad press for it. Over $500 billion deficit. Never seen anything like this in the history of the United States. They're running our country into the ditch.
again, as a percentage of GDP, actually Ronald Reagan had 1 year where he had a higher deficit as a percentage. And he realized the damage that it was doing to the United States, and for the following 6 years, every year, Ronald Reagan raised taxes. You didn't know that? Go back and look. So, anyhow. So they said it's going to be $521 billion. Well, it turns out it's going to be reported tomorrow. Now, this was supposed to be submitted on July 15th. The law requires the White House to submit the deficit, the information about the deficit, the legal deadline, on July 15th. But they're going to submit it tomorrow. At the end of the day, so it'll get lost in the weekend's news cycle, $420 billion deficit. And they've got their spin pre-prepared. Hey, it's $100 billion less than everybody thought. Well, it's not $100 billion less than anybody thought. It's $100 billion less than you said it would be. But anyhow, so that's the spin. So I just wanted to let you know about that. I'd like to get back to the Democratic National Convention. Some comments. Again, Al Sharpton talking about this. This is when he veered off. Sharpton was, you know, following his script for a while, and then he just went off, and he went off on this thing about he had, on Friday of last week, been there at the Urban League meeting when George W. Bush came in and gave his speech and asked the African Americans who were assembled there if, A, they thought that the Democratic Party was taking them for granted, and if, B, didn't they think they'd have more power if they were to split their vote between the Democrats and the Republicans. And Al Sharpton figured that it was really important that he answer those questions. And so here he is answering those questions straight up.
As I close, Mr. President, I heard you say Friday that you had questions for voters, particularly African-American voters. And you asked the question, did the Democratic Party take us for granted? Well, I have raised questions. But let me answer your question. You said the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. It is true that Mr. Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, after which there was a commitment to give 40 acres and a mule. That's where the argument to this day of reparations started. We never got the 40 acres. We went all the way to Herbert Hoover. And we never got the 40 acres. We didn't get the mule. So we decided we'd ride this donkey as far as it would take us.
Isn't that great? And we're going to ride this donkey as far as it'll take us. And that's the, you know, African Americans by and large have been with the Democratic Party since the 30s. I mean, it was, you know, they perceived Lincoln to be the great emancipator throughout the 19th century, but in the 20th century, they woke up, because what happened was the Republican Party changed. The Republican Party came into being in the 1840s, the late 1840s. You start out with the Federalists, okay? You know, Washington, Adams, the Federalists were the conservative party, and the Anti-Federalists were the liberal party, as it were. They became the Democratic Republicans. They split into a bunch of groups, and there was the Republicans and the Democrats. And Jefferson pulled them all together during the time that he was the vice president in the Adams administration, 1796 to 1800, pulled them all together and named the party the Democratic Republicans. And that was his party. He created that party. It's the longest-lasting political party in the history of the world. And in the 1830s, and their opponents were the Federalists. By the late 1820s, the Federalists imploded. They just fell apart. They disintegrated. They were gone. And so a new party rose up called the Whigs to take the standard of the conservative economic worldview. And then the Whigs and the Whigs were ascendant in the 1820s, 1830s, and early 1840s. And in the middle 1830s, largely during Andrew Jackson's administration, the Democratic Republicans stopped using the word Republican. They just referred to themselves as the Democratic Party. They dropped the word Republican from their name. It was too many words. So they just said, hey, just call us the Democratic Party. It's the party that Jefferson founded. And it's been called the Democratic Party ever since. No, it's not the Democrat Party. There is no such thing as the Democrat Party. That goes back to Newt Gingrich saying, Democratic sounds too democratic, so start calling it the Democrat Party. And now you even have a few suckers in the news business who have bought into that. But mostly somebody says Democrat Party, and you know that it's a con. Anyhow, so the Republican, and by the 1840s, the Democratic Party, the party of Jefferson, was starting to become quite corrupt. I mean, they'd been in power for 60 years, or 50 years anyway, if arguably, and certainly since 1800. And it wasn't going all that well, you know, and the schisms were developing, and the first Bank of America, well, the second Bank of America actually had collapsed in the 1850s, and 1856, the Great Panic of 1856, and out of this came a new political party, out of the death of the Whigs. The Whigs had imploded, and that was the Republican Party. It was formed in Jackson, Michigan, 175 years ago. And they had, you know, they had candidates for local and state office and national office, and their first really big-name candidate was Abraham Lincoln. And it was a reform party. They presented themselves as, you know, we're going to deal with the corruption of the Democratic Party. And, of course, then came the Civil War, and the Emancipation Proclamation and all that. And then after the Civil War, up until 1870s, the Republicans were still viewed as the party of reform and progress, and the Democrats were viewed as the party of the agricultural South and slavery and corruption. And the Republicans then made a deal with the devil. They got in bed with the railroads, these huge, huge corporations in the United States, in the 1870s. And Ulysses S. Grant, the Republican president, his administration was so badly corrupted by the railroad bribery scandals that when he himself wanted to run for a third term for office, with every probability that he would win, his own party refused to nominate him because he was so corrupt and his party was so corrupt. And in 1872, the idealists in the Republican Party, who still didn't see idealism in the Democratic Party, because it was also relatively corrupt, split off. And they create, you know, through the Grange movement, they created the populist movement, the progressive movement, and this whole thing just kind of came out of frustrated farmers, the wiping out of the middle class. They were very active from the 1880s until the 1920s. And they brought us the direct election of the Senate. Senators used to be appointed by the states. And in 1913 or 17, I forget which, we started electing senators. And in 1920, women can vote. I mean, these were the outcomes of the progressive and populist movement. And then the progressive and populists essentially infiltrated and took over the Democratic Party, which led to, and, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, who had been a Republican, you know, became the Bull Moose Party, became a populist. And they took over the Democratic Party heavily influenced it, which led to Franklin Roosevelt and the reforms of the Democratic Party. So once again, the Democratic Party became the party of reform. And we see this going back and forth and back and forth in history. So anyhow, that's the story here. Let's get back to Al. I just want to, Mr. President, did the Democrats take African Americans for granted? We're going to ride this donkey. Then he says, we got our voting rights under Democrats. This is great.
Mr. President, you said, would we have more leverage if both parties got our votes? But we didn't come this far playing political games. It was those that earned our votes that got our votes. We got the Civil Rights Act under Democrat. We got the Voting Rights Act under Democrat. We got the right to organize under Democrat.
See, there you go again. The Democratic Party again had become the party of reform. And this is where I think the Democratic Party is making a huge mistake right now by trying to go to the center. Because when the Democratic Party has positioned itself as the party of reform, much as the Republican Party did under Reagan, with the conservative thing, they came out, you know, they lied about what they were going to do with America, but it sounded good. You know, they didn't come out and say, you know, we're going to make the rich richer and the poor poorer and we're going to wipe out the middle class. No, it was, you know, all this opportunity speak stuff.
But the reality was that the Republicans positioned themselves as the party of reform in the 1980s. The Democrats had it in the 1960s and in the 1930s. And I think the Democrats should again position themselves as the party of reform, as the place to go if you want change. And I suppose to a mild extent they are, but I really think they should go so much farther. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you.
Tom Hartman will be speaking out in Santa Fe, New Mexico with We the People, a call to take back America, a Friday evening talk August 27th at the Santa Fe Armory for the Arts, to be followed by a Saturday, August 28th workshop called Waking Up to Personal and Global Transformation. Tom Hartman brings his wit, wisdom, and intelligence to Santa Fe the weekend of August 27th and 28th. Tom Hartman will discuss with us how America faces its greatest threat since a civil war. And Tom Hartman will look at how Western thinking, legends, and myths have caused global problems and endangered democracy and what we can do about it. To get your tickets and more information, call 505-988-2223 in Santa Fe. That's 505-988-2223 or visit greatmystery.org. Tickets for Tom Hartman are also available at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis: poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner bringing you today's feature story. Recently, a group of workers gathered in the Garment District in New York City to launch the Ain't I a Woman campaign, a national boycott against Liberty Apparel. Rebecca Miles was there.
The campaign demands that the manufacturer be accountable to their subcontracted workers. In 1999, 26 garment workers sued Liberty Apparel for sweatshop conditions in their U.S. contracted factories and failure to pay minimum wage. Many workers, when paid, were earning $3 an hour. Anna Chong from the Ain't I a Woman campaign.
It's been 5 years. For 5 years, they still refuse to pay their workers. Their kids are grown and they have not received a single cent. By not paying these workers, they're actually trying to change the law. They're actually trying to change the Fair Labor Standards Act. And because this will affect workers across the country, this boycott is also about holding all manufacturers accountable and all companies that subcontract accountable, and for them to stop hiding behind the subcontracting system.
What concerns workers is the increase in subcontracting, especially where subcontractors are not accountable when accidents happen on the job, or where the company suddenly disappears when there is any kind of protest, as in the case of Liberty Apparel and its subcontractor. David Ting, a high school student whose mother worked long hours in a nail salon.
The subcontracting system is now limited to the garment industry. White-collar workers such as lawyers and paralegals are employed through temp agencies, and although they are well paid, they have absolutely no control of their working hours and may work for years without contract.
We were unable to contact Liberty Apparel Company as the line was constantly busy. Their clothing line is sold in outlets like Conway and Family Dollar for families on tight incomes, and ironically is durable clothing for workers and hunters. For the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Rebecca Miles in New York.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
President George W. Bush taking powerful antidepressant drugs to control his erratic behavior. According to a story in Capitol Hill Blue, yesterday's Capitol Hill Blue, erratic behavior, depression, and paranoia. The prescription drugs administered by Colonel Richard J. Tubb, the White House physician. It's a double-edged sword, says one aide. We can't have him flying off the handle at the slightest provocation, but we also need a president who is alert mentally. Apparently, Tubb prescribed the antidepressants after a clearly upset Bush stormed off stage on July 8th, refusing to answer reporters' questions about his relationship with indicted Enron executive Kenneth J. Lay. Keep those M-ers away from me, he screamed at an aide backstage. If you can't, I'll find someone who can! Bush's mental stability has become the topic of Washington whispers in recent months. While the GOP loyalists dismissed the reports as anti-Bush propaganda, the reports were later confirmed by prominent George Washington University psychiatrist Dr. Justin Frank in his book Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President. Very scary stuff. Let's hear one last clip here from Al Sharpton. This is about the vote. It's so important.
Mr. President, the reason we are fighting so hard, the reason we took Florida so seriously, is our right to vote wasn't gained because of our age. Our vote was soaked in the blood of martyrs, soaked in the blood of Goodman, Cheney, and Sumner, soaked in the blood of four little girls in Birmingham. This vote is sacred to us. This vote can't be bargained away. This vote can't be given away.
And he goes on to add, this vote can't be sold, no matter how much the Republicans want to pay.
Mr. President, in all due respect, Mr. President, read my lips. Our vote is not for sale.
And that, yeah, what a barn burner. What a great speech. Anyhow, just absolutely, Al Sharpton is an incredible orator. He's, you know, you say, well, he's had his funky moments in his life, but he's an incredible orator. And we got our rights under the Democrats. We're going to hang on to them, he says. Amen. Thanks to Ira for engineering our program today. Thanks to Louise for producing it. Thanks to Shelby for streaming us around the planet on radiopower.org. Thanks to our sponsors for keeping us going here. Thanks to Michael Toth for our archives, as well as to Ben, who put them up on White Rose Society. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks to Jay for writing and producing, performing our music, our theme music. And thanks to you for listening today. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released.
The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie, Global Warning,